Hello, I'm Chris, and welcome to Foundations in Social Innovation. In this episode, we're going to be talking to taxi practitioners about the emotional side of social innovation, the ways it can affect your well-being, and what to do about that. This podcast is being recorded on unceded Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future, and to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which you're listening. In social innovation, we think a lot about how to include community members and people with lived experience in the decisions about systems, policies, and services that affect them. It's about being social in means. But in this module, the focus is on you as a social innovation practitioner. Social innovators, perhaps being the cohort who are most often forgotten about when it comes to designing good social innovation processes. But they, you, we, may be just as important. We all do this work because we want to help, we want to make the world a better place, we want to make a difference for people experiencing disadvantages. So more often than not, we concentrate on them, not us, in our work. We listen deeply, build empathy, work hard, develop new skills, and work on unpacking our own privilege. We put in the extra hours to get better outcomes for people on the ground, to meet the needs of the system, to stretch our clients, our teams, our partners, ourselves. These are the emotional labours of social innovation, and it's a significant part of the work. It's what results from showing up as a human to address intractable issues, and that's what we need to do. But it's these emotional aspects of social innovation that are most likely to affect your own well-being, and as a result, impact your work. In this module, I'm hoping to convince you to put yourself first because putting yourself first is more likely to lead to better outcomes. It's common sense, it's science, and it's the lived experience of social innovators all around us. The connection between well-being and well-doing is something that's already widely understood in traditional helping professions, like therapy, where therapists have therapists. Concepts like compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma are well known, and debriefing is an established practice. The wisest approach is to assume that the emotional labours of social innovation will at some point catch up with you, but there are strategies you can enact to mitigate those impacts. Strategies you can act should you feel things creeping up on you, and strategies you can enact to stop them creeping up on you in the first place.
So I worked with some very violent males, some perpetrators of pretty serious abuse, a lot of ex-offenders, and people with significant mental health experiencing psychosis. Mm. I guess what would be deemed sort of the troublemakers.
Yeah.
And that needed a bit of a different sort of approach.
Yeah.
So that sort of was my world. And then I did the Sticking Together project for 2 years, which was my introduction to taxi this wonderful world of design.
Yeah.
And then just seeing, oh, wow, there's like this whole other world of method that you can apply to complex social problems that I'd never been privy to.
Yeah.
And I think in my own wacky way, I was doing some type of social innovation somehow. But, it's just been so crystallizing for me to come into this now and do work similar but from a different angle with these folk.
Yeah. Mm. Well, let's talk about kind of one of the, I guess, sort of core practices of social innovation is that you're learning from lived experience, you're really informing innovation processes with the insight from people who are kind of in some pretty tough situations. And as a social innovator, you're pretty likely to come across some pretty big stories, some tough stories, things that may indeed be triggering for individuals, and we're trying to, you know, learn from that to inform kind of innovations that will affect lots of people in a positive way. Mm. But I'd be really interested to kind of hear about what are some of the ways that you personally would have coped with dealing with those big stories when you're dealing with those people in tough times, and what did you advise your colleagues
yeah.
at the front lines had to kind of to manage that.
Yeah, of course. It takes time. That is a skill, and that takes time to learn. Like, if I think back to how I felt hearing those stories at first, it was a bit of a rocky road for me because, you know, it's really difficult hearing people's pain. Mm. So I think what I did when I first started is I would share their pain, and I would put myself right in there. Mm. And I realised, I think, after that being quite taxing on me and probably not very helpful for the other person, I really needed to be compassionately objective. And so I guess I had some practices that I would sort of say in myself, and this is really more personal, this might not work for other people, but more around there's no harm right here, right now. You know, like, so no one's in danger right now. But some stuff might come up, and it's my role to hold that story and listen as if I've got 10 pairs of ears. But I started holding that story with not an outlook of sadness, but an outlook of hope. Mm. And when I started actually doing that, like started sort of looking at, well, none of that was for nothing. Surely there's something in this. I just started transforming my own outlook to pain as being about hope and optimism, which actually fueled my advocacy for individuals, because it helped me to look at, okay, the worst has happened. The worst is probably still happening. But what's my role to try and look at where's the gold in the rough, and how do we sort of leverage the pain to actually become something around transformation? So I used to sort of, I'd look at people in that view, or I'd look at pain in that view and sadness. And I found that to be very helpful, because it also just helped me to just take one little step away from it, because when I was too close, I wasn't helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
But so that took me a long time to learn that, though. And no one taught me. I had to learn that myself.
Yeah.
So you will have heard this from me 100 times, because I say it over and over again, but you can't give what you don't have. In our work, that means we can't support anyone to do anything, or, you know, increase their own agency, make different decisions in their lives, you know, any of our projects. We can't actually help them if we're coming from a place of crisis ourselves. So if we're not taking care of ourselves, how can we actually, you know, even suggest that we might be able to help take care of someone else, or support someone else to take care of themselves? You just can't. So we have to really get that into our heads first and foremost, that while we want to put everyone and their dog in front of us because we care about them and we want them to have amazing outcomes, if you don't fundamentally take care of yourself and put yourself first, you can't do that sustainably. I would argue you just can't do it. So taking care of yourself is really, really important. That's going to look differently for everyone. The tool that we have to start talking about that is the profiles that we create. So what's important in our life? Is that catching up with, you know, your family once a week for me on Skype and chatting with them about what's going on in their world? Is it, you know, going swimming twice a week with, you know, your best friend Susan, and then having a glass of wine and a parmy afterwards to undo all the good? Like, that is actually what creates well-being for you, if that's what's important to you. It's not all about, you know, hitting the gym, eating better, meditating. It's what actually is important in your life, and how are you creating the space for that. We are working in a stressful environment. It's always going to be stressful. I don't think that's going to disappear, but we can take better care of ourselves and know that that's fundamentally the most important thing if we don't want to burn out.
But I also think it's really important, really intentional debriefing, because sometimes, like with trauma, my learning from it is you can be in a project or with clients and they're telling you this stuff and you feel okay. And then a week later, you're just knocked over by it and it sits in you physically and you don't know what to do about that. And that's the point where it's really important to talk about, you know, what's hooked you and what do you need now in order to sort of release that hook, and what are the sort of things that we can put in place to ensure that removing those hooks are easier with time. And that comes with intentional practice and peers supporting peers, where I think we could get really intentional about saying, let's talk about that content. And how did that make you feel? And what's still in you? Because it sits in there. And I think just from having those conversations, that's really helpful. I did that outside of my job.
Yeah.
Because there just wasn't the infrastructure to do that.
Right. So my name's Carolyn Curtis, and I'm the Chief Executive at the Australian Centre for Social Innovation. But really, first and foremost, I'm a practitioner. And I have a degree in social work and have spent a long career in people's homes, removing people's children, going to court, street corners, hostels, trying to find better pathways for people and families to move forward. You know, ideally, it's best practice that in any of our projects or initiatives, when there's significant field work, that there's always debriefing, reflection, sharing time, whatever you want to call it, for people to really just openly share what's sitting with them. So it might have been things they noticed, it might have been things that they found themselves thinking about, it might have been memories it triggered, it might have just been sort of an overwhelming emotion that they had in relation to what they were hearing or seeing.
We were chatting the other day about preventative debriefing, if that's the right word, but sort of you can do it in advance to before you go out in the field.
Yep, but then it's important to top and tail it because you won't experience the kind of, your body won't experience the emotional response if in a preparation. It will only experience an emotional response once you're going through it.
There might be some folks listening to this who feel quite experienced. You know, I've been doing this sort of stuff for a while, are quite aware of themselves, that, and they might not have regular debriefing built into their work practices. I just wondered what you might say to them.
They're often the people that are most at risk, and just because you've been doing it longer doesn't mean you're immune. You can become used to seeing things or hearing things. You become better at knowing what to expect or what you think is going to happen, but you can't turn off your body's kind of internal response to it. I think the more we can keep learning about ourselves and our own triggers, it's a lifelong journey. And I think often, you know, my experience in the department is it was the people that were there for 30 years that hadn't invested in those types of practices and debriefing, whose worldview had become very tainted and very just a real loss of perspective. And their worldview became really counterintuitive to supporting families. And I think that's when it becomes dangerous. And I felt that even starting to happen to me when I was leaving the department. I just started to feel like the whole notion of family was pointless. Like, why even bother helping anymore? Because it's not going to make a difference. And my own worldview was becoming really distorted. So I think the longer you've been in it, almost the more you need to pay attention to it. That's what I feel like I've learned the hard way anyway.
In this episode, we're talking to taxi practitioners, but the emotional challenges of the work are not unique to taxi or social innovation, but endemic amongst the helping industries. Recent research by the Wellbeing Project found these things. 42% of people employed by charities and NGOs in the UK believe their job was detrimental to their mental health. 90% of nonprofit professionals in the US regarded burnout as the principal reason for people leaving the sector. 14% of humanitarian workers meet the criteria for depression, and nearly 20% for PTSD. The report emphasizes the link between well-being and well-doing, and how changemakers' inner well-being influences their work for the better or the worse.
So when people come to me, it's because for a few things, they are feeling really distressed after hearing certain things, or they didn't realize at the time they were hearing anything that bothered them, but days later they're still thinking about it. So they're like, that feels like a warning. They're not sleeping, or they haven't slept very well because they've been really pondering something. And then the fourth sort of fairly common one is that they heard something or experienced something in field work that triggered something for them personally. Now, there are some of those things that I would engage in and help them with and unpack, but there are some times as well where they, you know, need to seek more professional support. So they might go to EAP or, psych, etc. But yeah, the key is having good practices in place so people don't get to that point. And I think if you don't do those things, and you are doing lots of field work, you're hearing lots of traumatic stories, you are in a powerless position to do anything about those stories, that's when people can start to become more symptomatic. And that's when you start to, you know, get into the territory of things like compassion fatigue, vicarious trauma, and burnout are the three main ones. Compassion fatigue is really common for people in caring work, where I guess they just give so much that it starts to have an emotional wear on them effectively. Vicarious trauma is different. Vicarious trauma is when you are hearing sort of story after story, and it changes your worldview about something, and that's, you know, quite traumatic, and your worldview shifts as a result of being exposed to other people's traumas rather than you experiencing the trauma yourself. Our people are just very prone to using the word burnout. There is a difference between being tired and needing a break, and burnout. And burnout is more where you start to actually sort of physically, emotionally experience symptoms and exhaustion of complete sort of depletion. And it usually arises from, you know, low work satisfaction or a sense of being really powerless. So, for example, if our people are out in the field all the time, and hearing about all these things that are wrong with people and having a complete inability to do anything about it except write a report, people can feel really powerless about that. So powerlessness kind of lack of support structures leads to burnout. And burnout, you know, can be really quite serious.
I was in a constant state of admiration for the clients that I, like even yesterday we were talking about the folk at Ballarat. Like, these guys have been to hell and back several times. Mm. And we talked about moments of that. But what that process of them having been to hell and back means for their future is so powerful that it's like, how can you not just feed the old and the dark? But how do you sort of turn, you know, you use an alchemist approach and sort of say, how do we get the best out of this? And that's how my brain works now when I look at this sort of complexity. Like, that, let's not make that pain was for nothing. Like, how do we turn that into something brilliant?
Yeah, thanks.
And that protects me in having those conversations, if that's helpful for others.
Yeah. No, thanks for sharing that, Carl. And I guess everything you're saying is important if we're thinking of designing services or systems that support people.
Mm.
How do we ensure that sort of workers in those services and systems have access to these sorts of things as well, so it's healthy
Absolutely.
For them and they can sustain their work?
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important conversation to start to at the beginning of projects, because that's a foreign conversation for a lot of folk.
Mm.
Well, what do you mean? How do I feel? You know?
Family by family, I guess, really has embed some of the core principles around what good social work practice really is and what is at the heart of it. Reflective practice has been built into every layer of the model or the system. So just as we're seeking families to reflect and think about their learning, we're asking sharing families to do that so they can impart and share knowledge. And we're also asking coaches to do that through their weekly coaching to think about what they're feeling, thinking, learning as well. But it's always the first thing to get pushed, always the first thing to get bumped. If we could just help the powers that be realize that we, whether you're a design practitioner, a policy practitioner, or a social work practitioner, we will all be much, much better practitioners if we really invest time in regular reflection, debriefing, and unpacking of what we're thinking, hearing, learning, noticing.
So I had like zero experience in a social space before. I had been working exclusively in commercial environments. So I had a pretty strong suite of human-centered design skills. And I've always been an empathetic person, but I wasn't aware of, I guess, just how much more complexity there is when the focus of your work is outcomes for people that really matter, as opposed to outcomes for people which, you know, create a better experience for them in terms of interacting with a business or purchasing a product or flowing through a customer pipeline of some description. When you apply that to a health situation or something that's real, the complexity multiplies in a massive way, and I wasn't ready for that.
Right. What did that mean for you, like, as a practitioner coming into that space, and how did that complexity play out for you as a person?
Probably on a whole bunch of different fronts. The complexity of just understanding the acronyms that you were all using played out in a different way. Like, I didn't know how different departments came down to being acronyms and a whole bunch of methodologies I'd never heard of. So the best example is my first project was about evaluating a theory of change for a foundation, and I didn't know what theory of change was.
Yeah.
And that was my first project. So I had to learn quite quickly. But through that project, I learned that actually I'm pretty good at interviewing. And I'm actually pretty good at interviewing and taking notes on the slide. And then, so you learn what your strengths are. What I also learned through that project, though, was that I'm really not good at writing reports. As someone who has spent their entire career taking complex blocks of information and making them as simple as possible, to then suddenly be asked to be the person to write the complex block, like, I just don't know how to do it. I write one sentence, I'm like, well, that's it. Like, what do you mean there's more than that? Like, I...
Sounds so like you'd be a great writer of a report. But I guess there's just so many different things that you could do and that need to be done.
Yeah, well, and I think at Taxi you often are asked to do things end to end where you might only have been focused on one part of that. I ran my own consultancy for 7 years, never once produced a report. That was not something that I sold. I guess just don't think that Taxi expects you to know everything. You will be given a role narrative, and it's actually, you know, those role narratives are designed for complete unicorns, people who can do it all, and there's the expectation is that you've been brought in with a set of skills that are really useful to taxi, and trust and own that. And if you have any concerns about what they were, speak to someone who interviewed you, or so that you know this is what I'm bringing.
Nobody comes to taxi fully formed as a social innovator, because
yeah.
they're sort of, in a way, we kind of, it's our job, part of our job is to kind of make it up and to kind of bring together these different disciplines. But it does mean that you're exposed to lots of new and different ways of doing things, and sometimes mindsets that can be quite challenging to mindsets you might have had before. And I think that's true whether you were in coming from more of a sort of social practice direction or more from a design innovation direction.
I'd say a big thing is having that mindset of really trusting the process.
Mm-hmm.
So my previous mindset was needing to reach immediate outcome and solution,
mm-hmm.
like that. And if you didn't do that, there was something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this, what I've really learned is that that's not what's required. It's really about letting the collective, that whoever's involved, really take the work to where it needs to be. And so I guess for me, it's probably really trying to understand what my role is in that, that it's not about solutions or outcomes, but more it's about generating conversation, mm. making people feel safe to speak up and to be creative. Letting others lead, like, mm-hmm. I'm learning all the time about, you know, how to actually hold and facilitate a group of people. And I guess essentially what I've learned is it's about letting the collective lead and then letting individuals do that. So probably trust the process and trust the people, but give them the scaffold, like really put yourself out there first as an offering and a gesture to say, we're going to do this and we're going to hold this ambiguity and we're going to do it together. And I guess one of the big things that I've learned as being a social innovator is I now talk about the discomfort. I make that really explicit in, whereas before I probably was just thinking, holy shit, I don't know where this is going, or I'm a complete imposter here.
Yeah.
Why did taxi give me this job? You know, as opposed to actually getting comfortable, if I do, and I've got 14 years of representing people on the front line, so I feel like I'm an advocate coming in with their voices, and that it's not my job, and who am I to think that it's me to come up with a solution, but more just to find your feet and my feet in this process.
Mm.
And that's been really helpful. So just quickly talking about the ambiguity, I'm constantly finding myself saying more and more, okay, guys, in this process, if you're feeling really uncomfortable right now, because I can feel it physically in my gut, I believe that's us doing the work. So let's find comfort in that.
Mm.
And so my mum always told me, Carla, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And that's the mindset I take in this work. And it's really helpful. Yeah.
And we were just a group of us having a yarn, and I was saying, it's funny because I sit in lots of meetings and I do truly feel intimidated because I don't have PhDs and things in, but I have a lot of knowledge around lived experience, and that's what I bring, as well as being an Aboriginal woman growing up in, a non-Aboriginal Australia. So there's lots of stuff that I'm, you know, would have a PhD in, because you can't learn that at school. Or at university, or, you know. But I often feel intimidated because people, you know, qualifications often mean a lot. You know, and I don't have those qualifications.
Mm.
So, but I guess people still listen to me. I just, I do it in a different way. I found an ally in my non-Aboriginal colleagues. So there are, you know, a spattering of colleagues that I work with here, probably three of them, who I would talk to them and say, actually, this, and they would be my voice. I think I'm certainly a lot more confident than when I first started in talking and sticking up for myself or saying, oh, that's not right. So I think, you know, finding colleagues in your workplace that are true allies and friends to be able to be your voice until you feel confident. Lucy, I'll mention her name, was always my advocate. So we always sat next to each other and I'd always lean across and just say, psh, 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 psh. And then she'd go, oh, I think Vicky just is a bit concerned about this bit. And she was my voice, because sometimes when you're a lone person sitting in a room, I still have it now. I get very intimidated by people and wonder whether they think, is she crazy? Is she really thinking, you know, this stuff? But it's hard when you want people to be educated or learn and, and they can only see it through their own lens. My name's Vicky Charles. Lots of people here in Adelaide call me Aunty Vicky. I'm an Alara Mara woman from the Northern Territory who, due to white policy, was removed from my mother and grew up in Adelaide from the age of 2 months. And I have a long, vast working career and, you know, I could talk forever about that, but I won't. How I cope with a lot of stuff is I feel like I do that bit of explosion or I shut down. So I'm either really heightened or I just close off and, you know, want to go and sit in the corner and just be by myself. Most of the time, if I explode, I feel like Taxi as an organisation are really responsive in the respect of I will explode and say I have to go, you know, and go and sit in the park or whatever, and you guys are really good about that. You're not thinking that I'm just gone off and sitting in the park for the sake of sitting in the park. So I think your cultural understanding is a lot better than a lot of other places when we when I talk about how I look after myself. The main way I look after myself when I with anything to do with work is about family.
Yeah.
So I go and, you know, hang with my grandkids or, you know, go home and talk to the boys or my boys, or, you know, it's about that family connection which brings me back.
If we were to have a new Aboriginal member of staff here, like what would you advise them in terms of how to look after themselves?
I always find that this question, sort of that question, hard because not everyone's like me.
Yeah.
And so if another Aboriginal person came on board, I'd certainly obviously try to get to know them as well, and offer my services for cultural supervision if they felt that they needed that.
Mm.
I think having cultural supervision is really important to be able to have a bitch and whinge about something or to be able to debrief about something, and the person that you're debriefing to totally gets it because they have been in that same situation many times. There is nothing that replaces having another person of your culture in the room or to be able to talk to, and I think we found that, I found that with Dana, you know, I could have a yarn to her about anything and she totally understood because she was another Aboriginal person who felt the same or went through the same thing. So
if we had another Aboriginal person joining us here, like what are some of the situations they might find themselves that are culturally unsafe or risk being that?
Yeah, it could be a million things and it might be different things to them to me. So not everyone, we're not all the same, I guess. That's probably the most important thing.
What advice would you give to non-Aboriginal people or people from dominant culture about how to support people?
You know, with that question, I feel like I should throw that back to you and say, what have you learned
along the way? Yeah.
Because I've been with Taxi for 8 years and you've been here longer than me, and it's been a long, interesting journey in the respect of how accommodating taxi have become or willing to change and adapt and be.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably more of a me to you question than you to me.
I'll go, fair enough, Liz. what have I learned? I think there's lots of different things, right? I think there's something about not having, being very careful about assumptions about kind of what would work for a particular individual or what would be comfortable or uncomfortable for a particular individual. And so I think there's always talking to people to find out what works for them, what works to kind of identify when situations may throw things up or situations are going to be unsafe, and kind of taking that on a case-by-case basis. I think there's becoming sensitized to the things that are unsafe and kind of knowing what there might be, or being able to predict when they might come up, and thinking about, well, what might, you know, this sort of certain meetings we've been in certain projects that we've been in together where, yeah, it's not not kind of, you might think from the outside that it would be a kind of a culturally safe space, but I think there's sort of certain dynamics and norms and institutional racism happening, and knowing, well, what is it that I can do in that situation to address that. And then I think it is about enabling people the sort of space and time to reflect or take time themselves, and ensuring that, they're not, as you said, that it's not, you're not there as, or you're not isolated as the only Aboriginal person in the room, or the only Aboriginal person that you can talk to, or that you have those connections and opportunities to connect.
So for me then, I think that what, just building on what you've just said, I feel like being able to sit quietly in a meeting or, in a conversation, and having my work colleagues not necessarily think, just because I'm not saying something, that I'm being compliant with what's going on. It's more about being aware that, okay, I'm thinking about it. So I think it's about making sure, as a non-Aboriginal person, and you're sitting and listening or having a yarn or whatever you're doing with the Aboriginal people in the room, that you actually listen and not necessarily question. So, I might say, okay, I can't come into this room because of this certain picture on a wall, or, there may be something that makes me feel unsafe. And for you to listen and go, okay, how can I make that room culturally safe for you? Mm-hmm. Not, why is that not cultural? I worked for many government organisations who, think they're totally culturally appropriate. And you go, but they don't listen, and then they listen, but then they question why.
Yeah.
And so instead of going, okay, how can I help you, or what can be done to make it better?
How did I do?
I think you answered it well.
I hope this podcast helped you be more aware of the different kinds of emotional labour associated with social emotion, how things can manifest, and some common coping strategies. And whilst there are some common and common sense strategies, it's also worth noting that this stuff's highly individualised, and to some extent you'll need to work out your own triggers and the strategies and mindsets that work for you. But that doesn't mean that you have to do it alone. In this episode, we heard from Carla about the effects big stories can have on people and what happens when you hear others' pain and take it on yourself. Auntie Vicky shared with us how particular situations can trigger things from your own life experience. Carla and Ewan both talked about feeling out of their professional depth with social innovation because it's new, interdisciplinary, and evolving. And Carla touched on feeling challenged by social innovation practices because the mindsets and processes challenge how you've approached things in the past. And we also heard from Carolyn about feeling powerless because whatever you do doesn't seem to make a difference in big, intractable systems. And what might all this stuff feel like if you were going through some of these experiences yourself? The stress could manifest itself in your body as a sore stomach or a headache. It might manifest as not being able to focus or concentrate or think clearly. It might show up in your emotions, feeling particularly angry or particularly sad. It might show up as a lack of confidence in feeling like an imposter or feeling useless. It might show up as you feeling exhausted or having difficulty sleeping. And what can you do about all this? Well, the first thing is to be aware that this is likely to happen to you at some point. Then, to take personal responsibility for it, for yourself, but also responsibility for supporting those around you. You can plan an intentional debriefing, as Karen was saying, with people who are trained to do that, especially for the heavy projects. And you can do that before, during, and after events. And you may find that more effective if it's with somebody who shares your cultural experience or a particular living experience that you have, as Auntie Vicky found with a cultural debriefs with Donna. Know yourself, know your triggers and effective responses, and learn over time what works for you, as Carla advised us. And get others to help you on the journey, particularly if they've got more experience of this. This is about you, but you don't have to travel the journey alone.
We've had some challenging times recently with projects where we've been exposed to the stories, the hardships, the trauma. And that is the work. And actually hearing some of that, being exposed to that, is going to help us be far more effective at what we're trying to do. So we need to lean into it. It's not about avoiding it. The more we can push into that, the more we will achieve. But we do have to create good practices to look after ourselves. But it really, the strongest lever for prevention is people's sense of personal responsibility and how they take responsibility for how they're thinking, how they're feeling, but what they're being exposed to, what their colleagues are being exposed to. And even if they don't feel that their body's having a direct response in that moment, knowing what it could lead to. It's never going to be my job or your job or Carla's job or anyone's job to try and predict when that might happen. The best thing we can do is build good routines and rituals into our projects and initiatives and take personal responsibility if we start to feel ourselves lingering in a space or with thoughts for too long.